Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. Time is 1:31, February 25th, 2015. With me today, Senator Kelly, Senator Giesel, Senator Stoltz, and myself, Stedman. We do have a quorum, and we also have a new committee aide. That is Melissa Kukesh. She's sitting back here. So she'll be the committee aide for the rest of the session. We'll also, just as a quick reminder, we'll have no meetings next week. I'll be out of town, and then we'll start up the following week after that. On the agenda today, we have one item. We're going to have a presentation on the expansion of Medicaid by the Commissioner Davidson, and she's here today to present her presentation, if she could come forward and have a lifeline with her if she wants to. That's okay. We'll have you, after you introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, walk through your presentation, and I'd like the committee to hold her questions till the end of the slide, maybe before we go to each slide, and then we'll just take one slide at a time. That way the commissioner could go through her thought process on each slide, and we'll stay on track. Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today about the Healthy Alaska Plan. For the record, my name is Valerie Davidson, and I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. I will be presenting today, but also sitting next to me is John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner, in case I need a little bit of assistance as we move forward.
We have a brief Eddie. I can go ahead and bring the committee back to order, and we'll pick up with page two.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Valerie Davidson, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. And we recently released the Healthy Alaska Plan, which can be found on the department's website at DHSSalaska.gov. And the Healthy Alaska Plan found four things. One is that Medicaid expansion is healthy for Alaskans. Two, it's healthy for the Alaska economy. Three, it's healthy for the state general fund budget. And four, it also advances reform. And I will detail all of those points as we move forward through this PowerPoint presentation. So we know that reform is necessary. And Medicaid opportunities, we believe, are really enhanced with expansion. And one of the things that we know is that in our current fiscal environment, we have to ensure that we have a sustainable Medicaid program for the year, for years to come. In fact, during Governor Walker's State of the Budget address, he asked commissioners to take a really close look at our budgets and plan for a total of 25% cuts to our budgets over the next several years. And in our department, our entire budget is $2.7 billion, of which $1.7 billion is Medicaid. And so we know just from those numbers that really reform is our opportunity to identify and implement efficiencies, to make improvements, and also to deploy innovations to really minimize the impact to our most vulnerable Alaskans. And the truth is, though, we also have to have a conversation that goes beyond simple fixes, beyond just things like rate freezes, and looks at our current Medicaid program and talks about the opportunity of designing an Alaska plan, a plan that actually works for us here in Alaska, because I believe that together we can bend the cost curve on Medicaid.
Okay. Do we have any questions on the first slide? Just a quick comment for those listening. The target might be several, but it may be interpreted closer to three or maybe four. Okay. So just as general targets. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we're really building upon the work that the department has already undertaken, and these are some of the reforms that are already underway. The first one is controlling the overutilization of hospital and emergency room services. And we've identified over 5,000 people who are Medicaid beneficiaries who really overutilize emergency room services to the tune of about $29 million in annual emergency room visits. And the department began a care management program to really direct them to the appropriate level of care and to really, and we plan to build upon that. The target for that goal was $7 million in savings, or reducing that by 25%. And the method for realizing that is a policy, was simply a policy change in the department. It is a voluntary program currently, and to make it mandatory, we would probably require regulation. And some folks have asked me, why do individuals utilize the emergency room? Why is it that they do that? And the reason is pretty simple. For individuals who don't have any health care coverage, the emergency department of a hospital is the one place that they can go that cannot legally turn them away because of EMTALA, the federal EMTALA law, which requires emergency departments or emergency rooms to stabilize the patient before they send them on their way. The second reform that the department has undertaken is really looking at increased fraud and abuse prevention and control efforts. And this is really cost avoidance as a result of providers not submitting future claims based upon another provider basically being found to be fraudulent. And we really saw this a lot with personal care attendant fraud prosecutions. And one of the things the department did is required all of the personal care attendant providers to be registered as Medicaid providers. And by doing so, it allowed us to be able to look at a particular personal care attendant provider. For example, if we know there are only 24 hours a day, is this person billing for more than 24 hours a day for the level of service that they're providing? Are they doing things that we know are physically not possible, like providing billing for home and community-based services, let's say in Bethel, for three-quarters of the day and a quarter of the day, perhaps billing for that service in another community where we know that the traffic patterns don't simply allow for that. And so those kinds of innovations and those kinds of reforms allowed us to be able to drill down and get the detail necessary to be able to look at some of those fraud and abuse prevention and also other control efforts. And so the target here is really $15 million in annual avoided costs, and the method used to do that was through policy.
Yes. So in that one line you anticipate a cost avoidance, and that would be future dates. Do you have a time certain on that, or is it did the savings start in 2017, or do you know?
I think, through the chair, Senator Kelly, with some of those annual cost avoidance efforts have already begun, but we anticipate probably arriving at the $15 million mark in a couple of years, 2 or 3 years.
Thank you.
Go ahead and continue.
Thank you. Another category of reform efforts are with regard to home and community-based waiver improvements. And this is an option that was actually available to states starting in 2010 under the Affordable Care Act. And as we're talking about home and community-based service improvements or waivers, there are a couple of different options, and we're currently exploring two. One is a 1915 I waiver, I as in ice cream. And the 1915I waiver really replaces services that are currently being provided with 100% state general fund with federally, it would basically serve people who don't meet nursing level of care but do meet another criteria, such as Alzheimer's related diseases, traumatic brain injury, or severe mental illness. The types of services we're talking about here are personal care attendant services, general relief services, adult daycare, and also senior in-home services. And some of these we anticipate, although they're being paid for right now with 100% general fund match, some of these will be at 50% match, but others would also fall under the expansion group match. So that's one kind of waiver, the I waiver. The 1915K waiver allows us to really replace existing Medicaid home and community-based waiver services matched at 50% federal with 1915K services that are matched at 56% federal. So the federal match increases by 6%. And so for a combined total, the 1915I and the 1915K waiver strategy, our target is a $24 million annual savings upon full implementation, which we expect to be within two or three years away. And the method to be able to achieve that is through a waiver. Another initiative is patient-centered medical home initiatives. There are a number of initiatives underway. One is with the Primary Care Association, and this is really to help people who have chronic health issues to be able to receive the appropriate care that will allow us to be able to, and allow the individual to be able to reduce hospitalizations, again, reduce the number of emergency department visits. The target here in terms of savings is between $78,000 and $165,000 annual savings per 1,000 enrollees. And this is a recommendation that actually came from the 2011 Medicaid Task Force recommendation. And the method to do that is a regulation change to expand or to compel regulation. Right now, the demonstrations that are happening right now are really through policy and really are voluntary. The other is coordination with the Alaska Tribal Health System. When three things come together, if you have an Indian Health Service beneficiary, that's one, who is also a Medicaid beneficiary, two, who is seen in an IHS facility, including the tribally operated facilities here in Alaska, the state is allowed to claim 100% federal match. And that's true before Medicaid expansion, that's true during Medicaid expansion, and that's true after Medicaid expansion. And so we would like to target about 10% or $15 million in savings to the state general fund, and some of those are really through policy and also through agreements. But there are other opportunities that we have by exploring other kinds of waiver opportunities, whether we're looking at behavioral health and senior and disability waivers that allow us to redesign the way that we provide and pay for services, both for, and I'm sorry, I should have clarified, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, these reforms that are right now underway are underway for our existing Medicaid program. And so for the, there are some things that we can do that are quite frankly that are voluntary, but there are other things that we can do that if we negotiate a waiver with the federal government through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that will allow us to be able to waive certain kinds of things. For example, waiving state wideness, waiving choice, so that it will allow us to be able to take advantage of those, for example, 100% federal match opportunities that exist today. So we've also identified ways that we can also control the growth in the current Medicaid program. I'm sorry.
End of that slide. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Chairman Stedman. Commissioner Davidson, on this list, you mentioned that you would implement regs on regulations to affect some of these reforms. Do you have statutory recommendations for the legislature or that the governor is going to be introducing on achieving these reforms? Some of us have more confidence in things that are in statute.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, all of the things that are on these reform efforts that are underway are don't require a statutory change. They may require regulatory change to make them either, right now they're voluntary and they're demonstration projects, but we believe we may, to compel some of those things, we may require regulation change.
Thank you, Chairman Senator. As a follow-up, we have a 90-day session. The regulatory process is often much longer than that with the public process. So are you suggesting we should reforms first, that maybe we're not ready for expansion because we're not going to have anything ready by, we have less than 60 days now? That's a loaded question and intentionally leading. But if the reforms have to come first, how does that math and the calendar work, Commissioner?
Through the chairman, Senator Stoltz, we believe that these reform efforts that we've identified on this slide are actually already underway. We would like to be able to build upon those reform efforts, and we believe that reform and expansion can actually go hand in hand. But as you will see, as I get further along in the presentation, we also have a plan to be able to develop a longer-term reform strategy for 2017-18 and beyond that really allows us to be able to work with stakeholders, work with providers, work with members of the public. I imagine that given the interest of these issues, that we anticipate that that some legislators may have some ideas of their own of what they would like to see with reform, to be able to really take the time to develop an Alaska plan for future reforms. But the reason that we are interested in doing expansion now is, quite frankly, I will demonstrate in later slides, we have a very limited amount of opportunity to be able to take advantage of 100% federal match under expansion. Under the Affordable Care Act, to do Medicaid expansion for the first 3 years, and those are hard calendar years, 2014, 2015, and 2016, those are the only 3 years that you were allowed to, that Alaska is allowed to claim 100% federal match.
So let's, before we get too far ahead, and I think Senator Stoltz's question is kind of on point, what this beginning hearing is dealing with cost containment and and then the potential absorbing of this expansion and how we're going to fit it all in while we reduce the targeted expenditures 25% roughly. So we'll let you lay out that case so it kind of flows through, but that's the general gist of why we're here. There's 20 more slides or so coming, so you could maybe pick up on that. Do we have other questions on this slide? We'll go on to the next slide, please.
Thank you. So, as I mentioned before, we have identified ways that we can also control the growth in our current Medicaid program, and these include changing our personal care assistance PCA services for a savings of $2.5 million in general fund, and these would change the threshold to qualify for PCA services from one to two activities of daily living, and also doing other things that will that will allow us to be able to realize those savings. Other savings in durable medical equipment and vision and hearing, we've identified $1 million in general fund savings that we anticipate can be achieved in 2016. And these would require a little bit of a regulation change. And the third one is increasing the number of super utilizers that I mentioned in the prior slide for the management, for ensuring that people who are overutilizing the emergency rooms have the opportunity to be matched with a care coordinator who can help them, quite frankly, learn how to access a more appropriate level of care for what they need. Another one is dental, identifying $1 million savings in dental. And these include things like before approving medically necessary braces, for example, identifying that there's no decay in the last year, ensuring that a lot of that those cavities and those kinds of issues are dealt with first before approval for medically necessary braces are approved. Also doing things like changing the way that we approve dentures for the adult population to every 3 to 5 years instead of every 2 years as it currently is approved for. Oops, I'm sorry. Other things for utilization control for behavioral health services include really developing clearer program standards and stronger admission criteria for a thorough review for residential psychiatric treatment centers, acute psychiatric service settings, and really revising requirements for recipient support services. Transportation includes taking a look at our current travel and reinforcing current policies with regard to travel, ensuring that they are seeing that a provider that's closer, for example, rather than someone who's farther away. Looking at the number of escorts, if we know that we anticipate there are multiple members in the family who may require additional, who may require medically necessary travel, perhaps grouping that together so that those can be all done at once rather than, for example, sending a parent in for a referred service at one time and then later sending the child, which requires the parent to be sent as an escort, is another opportunity. And then also looking at also looking at developing a fee schedule for ground transportation, because right now the department is currently paying for build charges. We have identified other opportunities in, as I mentioned before, additional 100% FMAP opportunities that exist. And we've identified $10 million in savings that we believe that we can achieve in 2016. And those include things citizens that are currently that would take advantage of efficiencies that have been realized in the tribal health system. And there are some new facilities that are on board that were not available before. There's a facility in the Valley. There's another facility in Kenaitse. Barrow also has a new hospital. And one of the things that we see is every time that happens, it's not just the direct care that's also provided, but we also see savings in their ability to be able to provide those kinds of support and ancillary services, whether it's lab or those kinds of services as well, including dental services and a variety of services that are now able to be provided, quite frankly, in the tribal health system because of those facility improvements as well as new facilities that are being built in our state, including two long-term care facilities that are located in rural communities.
Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last week we had visits from the families who experience either through themselves or through their guardians and children, intellectual and developmental disabilities. They had two priorities that they presented, and they're both listed on here as on durable medical equipment. That seems like an easy fix. They said they've suggested that they need the department to make some type of a decision, allow the gently used, very expensive, durable equipment to be used. And some folks certainly want to make money on it and be able to sell it, and some folks just want to be able to donate it and make it available. That's one that seems like a pretty, I'll ask the two questions together if I might, Mr. Chairman. Would that require statute or just regulation? And then secondly, their second priority was the use of telemedicine for behavioral health, counseling, and speech therapy, and things like that. I just know my nephew participated in a lot of that. TV is his life. That would have been a pretty good medium for him instead of home visits, as they were paying for that. I assume that does require statutory changes. Would those comments on both of those, Mr. Chairman?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, you're right. I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't speak or highlight the DME issue. And you're right. We do have in our state really a surplus of gently used durable medical equipment that we believe can be reused, obviously after it's been appropriately cleaned and doing all of those kinds of things. Other states have similar programs, and we've actually had conversations with providers of who provide the state durable medical equipment so that they know that this is coming. This is a priority, as you mentioned, for individuals who need durable medical equipment, and people are actually on board with going forward. We actually have, I think, regulations that are available to go to public hearing on those kinds of things. So we're actually really excited. It's not often that you have the opportunity to be able to, and I guess one of the things that I have to say that, if I may take a step back, you know, our state often has to deal with really, really challenging issues. And when we really work together with our community and we work together with stakeholders and we work together with patients, they forward issues and ideas to us that are things that are really helpful. And the durable medical equipment one is one of those classic examples. And when we have those opportunities, we certainly should take advantage of those opportunities in any way that we can. With regard to your second comment on telemedicine, I think in our state we do have opportunities to be able to utilize telehealth a lot more efficiently than we have. I know that in a prior life that I had working in the tribal health system, utilizing those opportunities to work with telehealth for not only audiology services or ear, nose, and throat, but also for other services as well, is something that we really should build upon as a state.
We're going to ask the commissioner to give us more concise, shorter answers, or we won't get through the presentation.
Mr. Chairman, just does that require a statute?
Through the chair, this is, for the record, this is Sean Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services. I don't believe either of those two changes requires a statute. I think There are some situations if you wanted to make the reuse of equipment or the donation back mandatory, that might require a statute, but I don't know that we've done that evaluation, and we can follow up with you on that.
If you could work on an issue and get back, it's of interest to the committee.
Thank you,
Mr. Senator Kelly.
Commissioner, you had mentioned the $10 million a few minutes ago, and to it you assigned coordination with tribal health organizations and new facilities. And I just wanted to make sure, because I think we have, just through reading through the budget, determined that some of that money was for the ANMC facility that you're counting as savings. And just we're not counting that as savings because, as you'll recall, we needed to pay the bond bill for that facility with that. So that's kind of been counted once. So you might want to take out of your rhetoric that inclusion of that amount of money, because I think there's a big disagreement there.
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, we think that a part of those savings have been included in Senate Bill 88, but not all of them.
Oh, okay.
So for example, the projected annual savings that the department allocated to Senate Bill 88 was $3.8 million. Right. But a lot of the changes that I was mentioning in testimony and also described perhaps not very adequately in the in our memo to House Finance, right, is that we anticipate actually a total of about $8.8 million in annual savings. So much of that is really has not actually been captured. So I apologize for the confusion.
And then just as for those watching and listening at home, we continue the last couple of pages to talk about savings and budget reductions. In aggregate, what is the expenditure targeted from the previous year? Because a lot of times we get into presentations and they talk about budget reductions and the spending's actually going up. And if you're spending less than last year, you've got a reduction. If you're not, you're just slowing down the growth. So we need to get a little clarification, and you can always get back to the committee if you want on questions that you don't feel comfortable with just on the fly as we go through your presentation also.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
In addition, I think you have...
Could you speak into the mic a little bit?
I think you have included as your expenses that there's an expansion of Medicaid, and I don't know how much you attributed to the... I'm not talking about Medicaid expansion. An increase in the spending on Medicaid itself, I assume GF. But we have found that really Medicaid hasn't been expanding as it used to. Every year, it was a huge expansion, and that's either slowed down or maybe even stopped. So I know you guys have attributed an increase there. And if in your comments, if you could just kind of work in an explanation about how much you're attributing to Medicaid increase, irrespective of Medicaid expansion, I'd like to just know how much, in your opinion, it's grown from last year.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Kelly, we'd be happy to provide that information.
And if you can provide the questions back, we'll disperse them amongst the committee members.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next slide, I think.
Thank you. And then, so in terms of moving forward, we received some funds from the Mental Health Trust Authority, releasing the RFP, which I believe was supposed to be released on the street today. I'm working with a contractor who will provide us with some technical assistance. One of the things, and quite frankly, one of the reasons is that we've learned time and time again that Alaska is different. We're small in terms of population, so we don't necessarily have the large population that other states have, and we also have a large geography where travel is really a critical component in our ability to access care, and certainly for some of those specialty services. So the technical assistance will look at and evaluate reform efforts that are going on undertaken in other states, not only with that other states have undertaken with regard to expansion, but also for regular Medicaid. And looking at reform efforts, whether they're through waivers, whether they're through restructured benefit packages, but also engaging stakeholders, providers, members of the public to really have an open conversation and dialogue about where we think we need to be as a state. And also really developing, really, I mean, this effort really is all about taking time to develop, to build the right Alaska model and looking at what is it that we see our Medicaid program should look like in the future. And then a part of that RFP will also be requiring the contractor to work with us to identify clearly what the approval processes are, whether it's regulatory, statutory, budgetary, etc. So in terms of the timeline for the RFP, in February of today, the RFP is released. We will have a deadline for proposed submissions. We'll be meeting with the contractor and meeting with stakeholders and then doing a report back to the legislature in January that also discusses what some of, and also really presents a timeline for our path forward for reform for in the out years.
Commissioner?
Yes.
I don't want to rain on the parade, but we might not have enough cash in the bank to survive your time schedule. So as we work through this this year and next year, some of this stuff may get accelerated, either voluntarily or involuntarily. So I'm a little concerned, you know, if we have virtually no action and we start a year from now, it's going to be too late. So we'll work through this process and see where we go. But it's looking a little long in the tooth from the time horizon, in my opinion. Senator?
Thank you. Senator Stedman, Mr. Chairman, I just have one question. How stakeholders are defined, and I have a lot of people who view themselves as stakeholders, as federal taxpayers and concerned about the growth in government, whether it's the policy forum, whether it's Alaska Policy Forum, which has been a very active player, many other groups that have had very defined opinions on that. Can you tell me what their role in the process as stakeholders is planned to be?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, one of the things that we are actually open to everybody's reform ideas. I think that as a state, when we have the opportunity to all be able to collect what everybody's ideas are and to be able to have that conversation out in the open, we really come with better outcome. We end up with better outcomes. And so if we have, I guess here's my philosophy. I'm a pretty collaborative person, and I think if the only people I'm going to be meeting with are the people who agree with me, I could probably save everybody's time and just stare in the bathroom mirror, but I think that isn't necessarily going to get us where we need to be. And I think that taking the time to be able to arrive at a position that allows us to be able to speak with people whose opinions, quite frankly, and whose positions are completely the opposite of mine, really presents the opportunity to be able to have those conversations in the same room at the same time, so that we may not be 100% happy with the outcome, but quite frankly, there may be things that we can agree to live with to be able to define that outcome.
Your follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Sidman, Mr. Chairman. I would hope that, I hope the involvement isn't just an invitation to participate as a three-minute testifier, but there are people that are speaking for a lot of my constituents on this issue. Everybody that has a financial or vested interest is already at the table. They buy the plane tickets, and some of these groups are really reflecting. Some might call it a silent majority or a substantial number of Alaskans at the very least, and I would hope for even a more significant outreach than just saying, well, come to our meetings. I think there are some strong policy voices with a lot of expertise, and again, I too learn more when I talk to people that I don't have a total concomitance of agreement, and I appreciate that openness, but I'll be watching to see how much those folks many groups are not just allowed, but really actively invited to participate in this important policy discussion. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next slide.
Thank you. So as we move forward, we're going to be evaluating various reform options, and quite frankly, this is kind of a standard list of, as people in states look at reform options, these are some of the things that they consider. Everything from payment reform in Alaska, we really have fee-for-service payment structures that really incentivize higher service volume and rewards and efficiency in the delivery system. Two, other states are looking at different kinds of alternative payment mechanisms that really can drive improved value. Some states that are doing this include Colorado, Minnesota, and Vermont. In terms of strengthening primary care, this is really a way to make sure that one of the foundations of really efficient healthcare systems is that they really ensure that they have a really good primary care focus. So Colorado Medicaid, I know, has undertaken an effort to strengthen primary care to be able to change the way that they deliver Medicaid services. In terms of care management, this is really about ensuring appropriate utilization of services. And right now, we know that certain individuals who overutilize services are locked into a designated provider who controls that service. And other facilities are looking at care management, include the Mayo Clinic. So these are things that I'm just giving you examples of the kinds of things that other states have looked at, which we will be asking the contractor that's selected to also look at as well and evaluate how those kinds of things might work here in Alaska. In terms of workforce innovation, what are some things that perhaps our state can do that doesn't necessarily require a doctor? Perhaps it's a nurse practitioner, advanced nurse practitioner. Perhaps it's behavioral health aides, dental health aides, et cetera. And then we already talked about maximizing those federal 100% federal match opportunities, and we also spoke about telehealth as well, so I'm not going to go into more detail there. Additional reform strategies really center on increasing prevention and shared responsibility. Many folks don't know that we already have existing cost sharing for adults who are not also enrolled in Medicare, who aren't enrolled in long-term care services, or pregnant women. So we actually do have cost-sharing requirements for those adults for physician visits, for prescription drugs, and also for hospital visits as well. And so one of the things that we can look at that other states are looking at, for example, is higher cost sharing for non-emergency utilization of emergency room visits. Other states are looking at things like health savings accounts. I think Indiana recently made the news with their efforts to do health savings accounts. Other things are really choice restrictions, really directing enrollees and services to the appropriate level of care. Some of those we talked about as examples, but there are other things out there as well. Incentives for healthy behaviors. Some employer-sponsored plans are doing this already. Increasing access to preventive services to be able to improve health outcomes. And then the last one, I did want to clarify that the work assistance benefits for the expansion group is something that that is something that can be offered, but is not something that can be required. But we believe that it should be, our vision is that ensuring that people are as healthy as possible helps them in terms of the path to self-sufficiency. So in a nutshell, this particular slide are additional reforms that other states are looking at and the things that we would like to evaluate for how they might work here in our state.
Senator Kelly.
Commissioner, back to what the chairman said a few minutes ago about the time frame. What I'm a little concerned about, and I applaud what you're trying to do here, and I trust you. You've got a great reputation for getting things done. What I'm afraid, though, is that we really don't have time for a lot of this, and I have a feeling that we know what the reforms are that are working or not working in other states. Now, I know they're going to have to be tailor-made for Alaska a little bit because we're different. I mean, we don't have to go into how different we are, but we are different. So my recommendation to you, and it has to do with a graph that I look at every now and then. Every few days, we pull up this model, and we try to put in to that model different savings that we can get so that we can extend our reserves. And just about everything we do, they run out in fiscal year 2008, which is 2 years from now. 2018, my apologies. So I guess my point is that almost nothing we do changes that number accept just good old-fashioned hard decisions. And I think there are reforms in other states, reforms that you have, I'm sure you've come up with a few yourself. And my advice would be, I think you're going to get a lot of support from the governor and certainly from the House and the Senate. If you make some mistakes, good on you if you're trying something. But if we study this thing to the point where that graph that's in my office, our calendars actually reach that graph, you will have failed. So I'm saying, do it. If you make a mistake, I'll give you a high five for trying something. But I don't. This isn't the environment. You know what I'm going to say. I'll just leave it at that.
Any questions on this slide? Just a quick comment. One of the things I don't see here is any real reductions. If we're in private enterprise, we'd be cutting out our lost leaders and liquidating them. And to Senator Kelly's point, we may be sitting here facing those decisions. We can't print money. And unless the burn rate slows down precipitously, there's going to be services that are being delivered to the communities today that will not be tomorrow. So I applaud you on trying to get as many efficiencies and streamline as much as you can, and I'll be amazed if we can get there without actually changing how we do business.
Can I say one more thing, Mr. Chairman? I was in sales a long time ago, and we would take sales courses and read sales books, and we would have sales meetings and all these ways of doing stuff that you could somehow make sales bigger, right? And I saw this one pamphlet one time, and it was, you know, increase your sales capacity. It had all this big cover and everything. And you open it up, and it said, if you think you should do something, do it. If you don't think you should do something, don't do it. So I think my point is, we kind of, I don't know, but I think you guys know. You have all these things up here that if you could probably implement some of them. Like, we've been talking about health savings accounts since Phil Graham was a pup. And to my knowledge, we haven't enacted them all. Let's just do it.
We have 2 minutes per slide for the committee to stay on track. So we want to, you know, I guess get more questions and less statements, I think, for all of us, except for Senator Geisel. She's been quiet. If you'll continue, please.
I'll start speaking a little bit faster, if I may. So this slide really demonstrates who's covered now. And right now, people who are in the gap, who are people who are adults without dependent children, who earn less than 100% of the federal poverty level, and those are single adults earning less than $14,720 a year, or a little over $7 an hour, or a married couple earning $19,920 a year, or a combined income of $957 an hour based upon a 40-hour work week. And these are the folks who don't qualify for Medicaid right now under our existing program, but they also don't qualify for a subsidy. Under the Affordable Care Act, you're not eligible for a subsidy on the marketplace unless you have income between 100% to 400% of the federal poverty level. And quite frankly, it wasn't a donut. The donut hole that was created wasn't created in federal law. It was actually created when the Supreme Court determined that states had the option of expanding Medicaid. So what is Medicaid expansion? Expansion really offers three important opportunities. One is it offers a higher federal match, resulting in an immediate economic boost to our state. The second, and I'll explain these in further detail. The second thing it does is it reduces uncompensated care by reducing the number of uninsured. And we know that we have about $100 million in uncompensated care in Alaska hospitals. And quite frankly, it's because, as I mentioned before, the emergency rooms are the place that people who don't have coverage go to get care because they can't legally turn them away. And in Arizona, Arizona saw their uncompensated care rate drop 30% after just 6 months of expansion. And of course, when you have that level of uncompensated care, as any business knows, you to be able to be able to cover those kinds of that kind of charity care, you necessarily have to shift those costs to other payers. And it also, the third thing that it does, it also allows us to really take the opportunity to leverage the higher federal match to refinance some of those reform opportunities that I mentioned before. So who is it that we're talking about when we talk about the expansion population? It's adults without dependent children who are between the ages of 19 and 64, and they're not otherwise eligible for Medicaid or for Medicare. In other words, they can't qualify for those programs, perhaps because of a disabling condition. And these are individuals who have incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level. So for a single adult, it's about $20,000 a year, or an individual earning $976 an hour based upon a 40-hour work week, or a married couple earning about $27,500 a year, or a combined hourly salary of $1,321 an hour based upon a 40-hour work week. So where do these folks live? Almost 42,000 Alaskans, if you look around the state, it's not no surprise that they are clustered around where our larger population centers are. So in Anchorage and Mat-Su, it's about 21,000, about 50% of the population. In the Gulf Coast, it's about 13.9% of the population of the expansion population. In the interior, it's 13.8%. In northern Alaska, it's 12.4% of the eligibles. In southeast, it's 6.3%, and in southwest Alaska, it's 3.2%.
And that total—that's the 41,000.
Yes, those are the 41,900. 910 people who are eligible, not necessarily the number that will enroll. And so in terms of the population, on the left side, this graph that you can see, over 70% of the expansion population are in the workforce, and they truly are the working poor. About 44% of Alaskans are working, another 28% are unemployed, and they're actually actively seeking employment, and so we know that they are perhaps seasonal workers, they're recently laid off, but these are people who are actively looking for work. On the right side of this chart, you can see that more than 70% of the people eligible for expansion do not have a portable health care coverage. So about 43% have no insurance. About 30% have partial access, and that is defined as people who have access, for example, to the Indian Health Service, or they may have access to a limited health benefit through the Veterans Administration, or they may have access to a community health center. But those things are not a defined insurance plan. Those are not portable benefits.
Excuse me. So 58% of Alaskans are not in the workforce? Is that man, woman, and child? I mean, that's all ages, or is it?
It's expansion population.
That's the expansion population. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
But, Madam Commissioner, if you can get back to the committee and this, you have a nice little pie diagram here, you can do the. Can you break it down by region like you had the previous line?
Yes.
Because there seems to me to be a lot of the unemployed, which I think is going to be not equal around those regions. And then not in the labor force. There's always a concern if they're not in the labor force by choice or you know, there's a medical reason why they're not in there.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to do that. So one of the things we know is that when people aren't getting the health care that they need, we really are all impacted. And whether you're a health care provider and you're providing that uncompensated care to the people who aren't insured, whether you're the business owner who really feels the impact of when your workers are out sick, and when your employees can't get the care that they need, or perhaps you're an individual who's had to reduce your work hours or really quit working altogether simply because you have to deal with unattended health issues. And that's something that we can do for our fellow Alaskans who would be eligible for expansion. And as I'll get to shortly, it also offers us additional opportunities to save state general fund dollars. So, now that we know how many folks are eligible, how many do we think will actually sign up? And based upon information from the Lewin Group, they estimated about 63% typically in the out years of people who are actually eligible for Medicaid will actually sign up. Because just because you're eligible doesn't mean you're going to sign up, and that has certainly been our experience in Alaska. So part of the Healthy Alaska Plan included the release of a report by Evergreen Economics, and this is this is a firm that has been doing analyzing Medicaid data for the department for almost a decade. And we asked them to take a look at the information and refresh the information so that we had the latest and greatest information. And the Evergreen Economics report really provided analysis in three key areas. The first was the projection on the expansion population, which this slide shows. The second is the per enrollee cost, which we'll get to in a minute. And then the third is the estimate on the total spending on services, including both the federal match as well as the state match. So this slide, as I mentioned before, indicates that in the first year we expect about 20,000 people to actually enroll, although about 42,000 people will be eligible, increasing further down in the out years in 2021, about 26,000 people who would actually enroll. The next slide demonstrates the second portion of what Evergreen Economics was asked to provide is, okay, what's the cost per enrollee? What's the cost of implementing this program? And the average cost you can see in 2016 is about $7,250, increasing to about $8,400 in 2021. And some folks have asked, well, why is this cost lower than previous reports that had been generated by the state? And the reason is because if you look at the bottom portion of this slide, 54% are male and 20% of this group is between 19 to 34 years old, which we know from our existing Medicaid program are lower cost beneficiaries. And we, in terms of looking at a similar population, a good proxy for this is working age adults who are enrolled in the Medicaid program right now, who are enrolled and eligible by virtue of their children. And so just to demonstrate consistency, based upon our analysis of the data from the department's Medicaid budget group, between 2009, fiscal year 2009 and 2013, the average spending per enrollee for adults and family Medicaid, but again, these are adults in these similar categories, grew on an average annual basis by just 1% to $6,560 in FY13. We added a little bit of cost to that simply because we recognize that some of these folks would be included already in the catastrophic or the CAMA group, so we anticipate that some of that cost would be higher than the $6,560 that we see in our regular Medicaid program. Other kinds of things, we know that the legislature recently did a report on recidivism, and we know that one of our big challenges that we have in our state is how are we addressing our prison population. We know that the recidivism report indicated that if we continue at the rate we are going, we're probably going to have to build another prison. The report also found that a significant number of people who are right now occupying our prison beds, our hard prison beds, are people who are there for alcohol and substance abuse related crimes. And there are also a lot of people who, quite frankly, are waiting there for sentencing. They haven't even been sentenced yet. And so we have a choice, really, as a state. Do we want to build healthy Alaskans, or do we want to build more prisons? So if we agree that we should invest more in behavioral health services and by way of alcohol and substance abuse treatment services in order to avoid building more prisons, then the question is, how do we pay for that? The challenge we have with this population is they are predominantly adults without dependent children, because their children are not their dependents. They're in prison. And so this is a great opportunity for Medicaid expansion to be able to be invested in behavioral health services, for alcohol and substance abuse treatment services to be able to address this issue. Other states are certainly seeing reductions in their recidivism. States like Michigan and Texas and Florida, simply by investing in behavioral health opportunities by way of alcohol and substance abuse services and Medicaid expansion, because it requires behavioral health parity, is a great way to be able to finance that effort.
Senator Scholz.
Thank you. Just a quick one, Mr. Chairman. I just want to clarify. Are people incarcerated for substance abuse and alcohol offenses or aberrant acts while they're engaging in alcohol? I think we I don't want that on the record that we have a warehouse a bunch of drunks and alcohol abusers, but they're there for other aberrant acts other than alcohol abuse.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
So we also know that expanding...
Some of those are also pretrial, correct?
Yes.
That would include, because you mentioned earlier that the population was problematic.
Okay. I should have said through the chair, Senator Kelly, yes.
You should have got the chairman's attention, but that's okay. Not that I pay attention. We'll go ahead and continue.
I'm already leveraging those opportunities and the invitation to make mistakes, so thank you for your patience. As I mentioned before, this access to health care also means that we'll improve our health outcomes and increase productivity and independence. The number of uninsured Alaskans would be reduced by half, from 20% to 10%. More Alaskans would receive preventive and primary care. Our state mortality rate would drop, according to the Harvard University study of what happens when people in other states increase their health coverage. And also, we know that we're also addressing some other issues in our state that have been challenges for us for quite some time, in terms of domestic violence and sexual assault and homelessness. And we know from other states that have expanded Medicaid that they are seeing certainly some benefits in these areas as well. So now the third thing that Evergreen Economics provided to us as the third leg of their analysis is what is the estimate of the total spending on services, including the federal as well as the state share. And so, as I mentioned before, on the top portion of the slide, you can see the match is 100% and then transitioning to 90% in 2020 and beyond, and it transitions down. In terms of resources, as I mentioned before, these are hard years. These are not rolling years. In 2016, we project the new federal revenues will be $145 million and increasing I think that might be a typo in 2021. I apologize. Oh, no, that's right. Increasing to about, let me double check this slide. I apologize. On 2021, I think that amount was increasing to $224.5 million in 2021. I apologize for that.
Total funds, that's your federal match.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And then, so what we know is, oh, I get it. I see what I did. So as we move forward, we know that that's over $1 billion in new federal revenue to Alaska during the first 6 years. And just in FY 2016 alone, every day of delay costs our state $398,452 a day in lost federal revenue. And a loss like that in our challenging fiscal environment is significant. But now we're going to move on to what the state portion of that is. So this slide really highlights three different factors in terms of what our state spending is on expansion. And the first, of course, is cost. That includes the state match, which starts at zero in 2016 and then transitions to $19.5 or $19.6 million in 2021. But it also includes some administrative costs, which start at about $1.3 million and increase to about $1.6 million. And those costs are really positions to be able to deal with the increased enrollment volume and also to increase payments that are going out the door to be able to reimburse providers for those services. The second category in the middle are really some offsets, and these are some initial savings that we were able to identify really quickly. Alaska actually saved state general funds by covering this new group of adults, and these are costs that we currently pay for as a state with 100% general funds. And transitioning to cost to Medicaid, again, saves general fund expenditures. And there are about $6.6 million in savings that have been identified during the first year of expansion alone, including $1 million in the CAMA program, $1.5 in behavioral health grants, and about $4 million identified in corrections. And those offsets really increase in the out years to about $24.5 million for just those three categories that we've identified here. We do expect to see more savings, quite frankly, in the out years through additional reform efforts that we highlighted earlier. And then so the third factor we need to consider is what the net savings is to the general fund and corresponding federal revenue. So you can see that in that net savings to state general funds, we actually save resources by expanding Medicaid.
And if you could give us an idea on the sensitivity of these numerics by role. Maybe get back to us if you could.
Sure, Mr.
Because if we're, like in 17, if we were going to save $8 million, we ought to cut our GF spending down. We'd jump on it like a dog on a bone. But obviously there's some reluctance to believe the numbers. There's the politics of the adoption, and there's just the straight, financial decision. So if you could get back to the committee on the sensitivity of these.
We'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman.
And maybe you can give us a little idea off the top of your head. Are you within $5 or $10
Like the spread. Mr. Chairman, one thing I would say about the spend, the bulk of the spending comes actually in the service component, and because in the early years the match is at 100% or near 100%, then there's not much sensitivity in terms of the impact on state spending. Total spending might be very sensitive, but there's a lot less sensitivity in terms of the general fund spending, just because the general fund portion starts out at zero and then slowly raises to 10% of the total over time. The administrative costs are relatively stable. We believe we understand them pretty well and would not expect them to change much if, say, we saw a greater increase in the population coming in. But I think the two primary areas where these numbers might vary would be the average cost per individual and the total number of individuals. And both of those, because of the very high level of federal spending in the early years, would have a minimal impact on the state general fund portion.
So how many employees are you looking at picking up on your administrative costs?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, we have identified 26 positions. 23 positions would be dedicated to enrollment efforts, and then 3 positions would be dedicated to paying providers.
And how efficient is the software you're using in the projection of 26? Is this under an older system or newer system? How hard is that 26 number?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Mr. Chairman, we have been very public about, we are experiencing some systems challenges with regard to the conversion from ARIES to the eligibility information system to ARES, which is an enrollment system. The go-live date was originally scheduled to be in October of 2013. The go-live date was actually October of 2014. And one of the things we've done is to bring back a previous director of public assistance who is now back and is doing things like doing overtime with staff and being able to borrow additional staff from other areas of the department to be able to get those backlogs cleared. We are working with Deloitte, the contractor, to make sure that we are on time and on schedule for a July enrollment implementation date. So that's on the enrollment side. On the provider, on the payment side, we have, the department has been undergoing a conversion from an old system to a Medicaid Management Information System, MMIS, which is a contract with Xerox. And we have made great progress with Xerox, but you should know that because of the delays to providers that we experience and also the additional, quite frankly, the additional work that was required of individuals in the department for healthcare services. We have pursued liquidated damages against Xerox to be able to recoup some of those expenses that the department had to incur just to get providers paid. And then in terms of other contractual damages, that hearing will happen in August. But we have been working with Xerox. They have a corrective action plan, and they have indicated that they expect to have things on track for a July enrollment and start date.
So if you can elaborate a little bit more on the 26 positions and how quickly they would be filled, and I assume by your answer that these 26 new positions are going to be using the upgraded software, and the calculation for needing 26 people was based on the new software, not on the old, less efficient system. And that's assuming there's efficiencies in the new system, which I'm not being sarcastic, but it's an assumption that I hope holds true in the question.
Yes.
Okay. And how is the 26 people going to be phased in? And you need them all on day one, or enlighten the committee a little bit on how you're going to structurally implement this?
Mr. Chairman, I think our plan is to attempt to have almost all of them there as soon as possible in the fiscal year, once we have the authority to bring them on board, because one of the things that happens in this kind of setup is when you start something out, you get a lot of applications. Some of your work is around maintenance, but some of your work is actually taking applications, including for people who are not eligible. So you expect a very high level of application in those initial months. Those applications go down, but the caseload builds, and you convert that work to doing, if you will, the maintenance work involved. And we do expect to be working these in the new system, and the new system is supposed to be ready to receive these applications for the expansion and allow us to process them in July.
I'm still a little confused, because you hire 26 people, you got to get them trained. Fiscal year starts July 1. You can have all 26 people trained and ready to go on second week in July or something, or what? I don't see how the mechanics work, because you've got a budget that has to be signed and implemented before you have budgetary authority. What's that? That's right. We got a lifeline coming.
Yes.
We'll get some of the 26 people on this unemployed list working.
I hope. For the record, Chairman, my name is Ron Creer. I'm the Acting Director for the Division of Public Assistance. Our ideal goal would have been to bring these positions on several months before the start of the fiscal year. That would have been ideal. With that reality not going to given that that reality is not likely to happen, we've also, staging up to that, have requested long-term non-permanent positions that are going to be able to carry some of the weight leading up to the July go-live for expansion. So we're kind of staging the workforce in order to meet that demand. You're correct, it takes weeks to hire and recruit. As soon as we've got the go-ahead to do that, we will implement. We've got a pretty aggressive training schedule, so we can bring people up to speed fairly quickly on the Medicaid component. It's a rules-driven eligibility system, so there's a little less of the technical work behind it. So we're pretty confident we're going to be able to get the staff up and running pretty quickly to do the work. And if, the commissioner mentioned a backlog of work. We're really driving hard to reduce that so that we'll have a core body of staff as well that are now that are currently in our employ that will also be able to step in to help that work. But in the long term, we're going to need those additional positions to absorb the expansion group.
I just sometimes have trouble, I guess, putting the whole pie together because we're going to reduce our GF spending. We're going to reduce our headcounts. Some areas we're going to add, like in this case, 26. Hopefully we have negative $8 million in 2017. But the whole pie has to come together for less people and less GF outflow. And our Kelly here won't have any hair by the end of next year because the burn rate of our cash is phenomenal. And I think a lot of the folks in the building are starting to realize that when they look at Ledge Finance's analysis. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It kind of reminds me of the math and the premise when the Affordable Care Act passed. It was we were going to do more, spend less, and save money. And I'm not understanding the math, Mr. Chairman. You and I both used to be upstairs in another capacity. I'm a little away from that now, but I'm still kind of plagued by that dilemma of how I just don't understand the math. And I guess the larger question I have in addition to that, Mr. Chairman, is does the administration think you have the ability and the authority to proceed with or without legislative approval of through other avenues and including even funding these positions with or without the reforms?
The commissioner can get back to the committee on that.
That's a larger question. Thank you.
What a question.
Oh, it's a straight-up question.
But you can get back to the committee. So I think we'll be working through that the next few months on this. If we have a few more minutes and we've got one more page, then Commissioner, I'd like to leave a little time for wrap-up also.
Okay. So, in conclusion, as we have demonstrated, the Healthy Alaska Plan is not only good for improving the health of Alaskans, it's also good for the economy. Based upon a study that was done by Northern Economics, found that it's about a little over $1 billion in new federal revenue, about 4,000 new jobs. Those aren't just healthcare jobs, those are other jobs as well. About $1.2 billion more in wages and salaries paid to Alaskans. And on the economic note, I know that as we are facing our budget challenge in terms of pressure to diversify our revenue streams in our state, I know there are efforts underway to diversify beyond just oil, whether it's the LNG, whether it's mining, whether it's other opportunities. We know one of the things that we do know is that we support those, but those things take time to build. It takes time to be able to construct those projects. It takes time for those extractions to occur at a sufficient volume and at a sufficient price for those to yield additional revenues to our state. Medicaid expansion is one of the ways that we can shore up our economy in the short term by infusing $145 million into our economy everywhere that healthcare is provided in our state. It's not just Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks. It's everywhere that healthcare is provided. and $1 billion in federal resources to our economy at a match rate that is about the same in the out years as what we currently pay for road maintenance and airport maintenance is probably a good investment. The reason that we continue to pay the about 10% match for runway improvements and road improvements is because we recognize that people, in order to promote business in our state and to contribute to the economy, we have to have safe roads to travel on, and we have to have safe runways to be able to travel on as well. And we recognize that it is an important investment into our state. And we need to start thinking about the investment of healthcare in the same way, that we want Alaskans to be as healthy as possible. And as I mentioned before, people can't work, they can't hunt, and they can't fish if they're not healthy enough to be able to do so. And this is a way to allow us to be able to increase the health of our population, allow us to mitigate some of the impact to our economy quickly, using 100% federal dollars, and in the out years, 90% federal dollars, while also having the opportunity to address some pressing health issues that our population faces, particularly in the areas of behavioral health. So many of our population are who need behavioral health services, whether it's alcohol or substance abuse treatment services, are childless adults. And right now, that category of Alaskans does not qualify for Medicaid. And it is one of our ways that we can invest to be able to get us to be able to improve that situation for our state.
Can you maybe help us a little bit with the rural hospitals? You mentioned the three major population centers. What, generally speaking, what would be your expectations of the smaller rural hospitals?
So
impact on them.
We know that wherever Medicaid services are provided, that we expect that those federal revenues will inure to those communities in which that health care is provided. But in terms of the community-by-community breakdown, we actually have and can forward to the committee. I should have brought copies. I apologize. We have a breakdown by district of newly eligible population, the number of projected enrollees that we anticipate will enroll, and the federal matching funds that correlate with those individuals. In some communities, it is as small, in 2016 only, it is as small as $2.2 million, but in the larger communities, I think it is as high as $4.7 million in 2016 alone in federal match.
If you could, you know, give copies of that to myself, I'll get it to the committee members. Do we have any final questions from the committee member?
Chairman?
Senator Stoltz.
Just a quick math question to the commissioner. Is that $1.2 billion, is that a single or multi-year benefit?
I'm sorry, Mr. Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, the impact to the economy, I should have clarified here, I apologize, is in the first, I believe, 6 years of expansion. So it's a combined impact. I apologize.
I suspected, Mr. Chairman, it looks $300K per position. I figured it might have been. Thank you, sir.
Any final comments before we retire for the day?
I just wanted to say thank you so much for the opportunity to testify about the benefits of Medicaid expansion and to be able to testify about the Healthy Alaska Plan. And I look forward to those great conversations about reform opportunities in the future. And I can assure this committee that I have already made some mistakes. I anticipate making some more, and I appreciate being called on them when I do, because we all have the opportunity to improve. And so thank you so much.
Well, the entire state's in this financial soup, so we'll all work together to try to get us out of it. And quite frankly, we've been here before. It's not the first time. We will, again, not have a meeting next week. I'll be gone, and then we'll pick up the pace the following week. We are adjourned.